Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei tells visiting Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro that Iran and Venezuela's experience shows resistance is a path to victory against U.S. pressure. Intense fighting is underway between Russia and Ukraine in Severodonetsk in the eastern Donbass region, as Kiev says it remains in control of the city's chemical plant. And people hold nationwide rallies in the U.S. to push lawmakers to take action on gun violence in the wake of recent mass shootings throughout the country. Hello everyone, and thanks for tuning in to World News. And our leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says experience shows resistance is only path to victory against America's pressure campaign. In a meeting with the Venezuelan president, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said that Iran and Venezuela have managed to defeat U.S. hybrid warfare. The leader said Washington imposed the most severe sanctions on Tehran under so-called maximum pressure, but Iran managed to defuse the U.S. plot through resistance. Ayatollah Khamenei welcomed the signing of a 20-year cooperation agreement between Tehran and Caracas, urging efforts to implement it. The leader said Iran has proved it does not shy away from helping its friends. Venezuelan president thanked Iran for its support for Caracas in the hard fight against the U.S. Nicolas Maduro said Tehran helped Caracas get out of a very difficult situation when no other country supported the Latin American nation. He said Venezuela managed to resist a multidimensional U.S. war and is now better off than it was. And with respect to that cooperation deal, 20-year cooperation deal between Iran and Venezuela, Salman Kujuri has your details.
Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi and his visiting Venezuelan counterpart, Nicolas Maduro, have signed a 20-year document on comprehensive strategic cooperation, which mainly covers a wide range of areas, including petrochemical, oil, economic, tourism, cultural, and political fields. In a press briefing after the signing ceremony, President Raisi and his Venezuelan counterpart Maduro said the two countries should work together closely in areas such as trade, economy, agriculture, as well as science and technology. They also hailed establishment of direct Tehran-Caracas flights as an opportunity to enhance relations and bring the two nations closer.
Venezuela has shown that it has put up exemplary resistance against the enemy's threats, sanctions, and imperialism. The Iranian nation, too, has been under numerous sanctions and threats for more than 40 years now. But the Iranian people have turned these sanctions into an opportunity to further make progress.
We will witness how the new world will take shape and how we will stand up to problems and secure progress. Iranian and Venezuelan youth should know that the future world will enjoy equality and justice, and that we will stand up to imperialism.
Earlier on Friday, in an interview with Iran's Spanish TV channel Hispan TV, Maduro said Venezuela and Iran are on the front line of shaping a world free of imperialism and dominant powers. Maduro also hailed Iran's courageous move to send fuel tankers to his energy-hungry nation, saying Tehran's delivery of oil to Caracas was a great help to the Venezuelan people. Heading a high-ranking political-economic delegation, Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro arrived in Tehran on a two-day state visit at the invitation of Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi. This is his second visit to Tehran. The first one took place about 6 years ago.
Both Iran and Venezuela have managed to withstand the economic pressures from the United States and have closely cooperated to offset the impact of the illegal sanctions, especially in their energy sectors. Salman Kujrip, Tehran.
Political analyst Mostafa Khoshchesh explains how close cooperation between Iran and Venezuela is helping them overcome their problems.
Iran rushed to Maduro's help and the Venezuelan people's help. The people were queuing lines, waiting to fill their tanks, car tanks. And Iran sent a dozen tankers, not only taking petrol to Venezuela, but also spare parts for refineries, engineers, technology, and everything, as well as additives and to help the country come back online, bring their refineries back online. And that soothed, actually, the crisis in the country and defused the U.S. plans for overthrowing the government in there. So the two are also major oil-producing countries and could help each other with, managing the global oil market as we are approaching winter. And then the energy prices are rising because of the Ukraine war, and the U.S. needs much of, energy import as well as the Europeans. And they need energy, and the only two countries that might increase supplies in the market and have reserves are Venezuela and Iran. So they could play a major role in coming months with regard to energy market.
Iran's foreign minister censors the U.S. and its three European allies for submitting an anti-Tehran resolution to the International Atomic Energy Agency's Board of Governors. He says the move was politically motivated. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the remarks in a phone call with the U.N. Secretary General Antonio Guterres. UN chief played down the seriousness of the resolution, calling it a recommendation. He stressed the need to continue the Vienna talks. Guterres said diplomacy is the best path to tackle differences between Iran and other parties to the JCPOA. The resolution passed Wednesday accuses Tehran of inadequate cooperation with the IAEA. Iran has dismissed the allegation, vowing proper reaction and saying those who submitted the resolution put their agenda ahead of the agency's credibility. Russian and Ukrainian forces are locked in an intense battle in the city of Severodonetsk, one of Ukraine's last holdouts in the eastern Donbas region. Kiev says it remains in control of a chemical plant there where hundreds of civilians have taken shelter. According to Ukrainian officials, some 800 people are hiding underneath the Azot plant. A pro-Russia representative from Luhansk region, though, says about 400 Ukrainian troops are who's holed up there. The official added that those fighters are trying to negotiate their way out of the city, but saying such demands are unacceptable. Elsewhere, Kiev has reported the deaths of 24 children in the southeastern city of Mariupol, which was captured by the Russians in mid-May. Mariupol's mayor has reported cases of cholera and other infectious diseases, calling for humanitarian help. Meanwhile, Moscow says its air defenses have shot down three Ukrainian warplanes. This is while Kiev is asking the West for more advanced weapons. Now, Russia is warning of responding proportionately to buildup of NATO forces. This after several Eastern European countries are calling on NATO to strengthen the eastern flank over the Ukraine war. Now, Russia's foreign ministry says that Moscow's response will be appropriate. Ministry added such a response will intend to neutralize potential threats to the security of Russia. Moscow was responding to a call from nine European countries, including Poland, asking the U.S.-led military alliance to consolidate power along its eastern regions. Last month, NATO announced it was no longer bound by past commitments to hold back from sending forces into Eastern Europe, citing Russia's attack on Ukraine. Thousands of Americans hold nationwide protests that demand tighter gun control laws amid a spate of mass shootings in the U.S.
Everyday shootings!
Protests were held in Austin, New York, Washington, D.C., and other U.S. cities. Rallies were organized by March for Our Lives. That's a group created by survivors of a high school mass shooting in Parkland, Florida in 2018. Activists are calling for restrictions on assault rifles or an outright ban. Many deadly mass shootings, including the most recent one in Uvalde, Texas, that killed 19 elementary school students, have been carried out using an assault rifle. According to Gun Violence Archive, firearms have killed over 19,030 people in the U.S. so far this year. 20 years ago, two 14-year-old South Korean girls were walking with their friends to school or to a birthday party when they were ran over and killed by a U.S. military vehicle. Saturday, thousands rallied to mark that tragic death or the tragic deaths and call for a change in U.S.-South Korean ties. Frank Smith reports.
Thousands of South Koreans gathered in downtown Seoul to remember the tragic deaths of Shin Mi-sun and Shin Hyo-soon, ran over by a U.S. military vehicle on their way to their friend's birthday party on June 13, 2002. The children's family's lawyer hopes for change in U.S. relations and influence on Korea.
The massacre of two middle school students is a symbol of unequal South Korea-U.S. relations. In that regard, I think that the work of candlelight among our people to establish an equal relationship between South Korea and the United States in the future and move toward peaceful reunification of the Korean Peninsula remains unfinished.
Two U.S. soldiers were charged with negligent homicide, but acquitted in a U.S. military court amid anti-American candlelight protests. The deaths of Mi Sun and Hyo Soon under the tracks of a U.S. military vehicle 20 years ago are but one episode of a problematic alliance relationship, from the Status of Forces Agreement to the cost of hosting 28,500 troops in South Korea. Alliance ties are a constant source of controversy and debate. Some argue South Koreans view the presence of U.S. forces as an obstacle preventing the country from exercising sovereignty.
It's not fit for the global era and very risky for South Korea to cling to a falling sun with the status of American hegemony declining so much. I hope we can establish more neutral diplomacy reflecting our national interests.
New President Yoon Suk-yeol seeks to strengthen the South Korea-U.S. alliance, a shift in policy that worries many South Koreans. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Leader of Lebanon's Hezbollah movement warns the Israeli regime against gas drilling in the East Mediterranean that is claimed by Beirut. Sayed Hassan Nasrallah says Hezbollah is capable of preventing Israel from extracting gas in disputed waters. Earlier in our News Review program, we discussed this issue in length with our guests. Here it is.
It's time now for the News Review of this bulletin. The leader of Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement has urged Israel to stop extracting gas from a maritime field in disputed waters. Nasrallah described Israel's operation in the disputed waters as an act of provocation. He also warned a Greek company hired by Israel against proceeding with its activities. Nasrallah said the company is a partner in the Israeli aggression and urged the firm to pull out its ship immediately. The Hezbollah chief said that Lebanon has the right to exploit natural resources from the field, stressing that the movement has the capacity to prevent Israel from extracting gas there. During the weekend, an Israeli floating gas production unit arrived in the disputed maritime zone. The move sparked anger of the Lebanese government, which warned Israel against any aggressive actions. Mayam Saleh is our correspondent joining us from Beirut to explain more about this, and we also have Firas Al-Najim, who's a manager of the Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, joining us from Ottawa. Welcome to you both. Mariam Saleh, first of all, tell us what this dispute is all about, briefly, of course, so we can understand the stance that Hezbollah has taken and, in turn, of course, Lebanon.
Yes, well, of course, as you know, the sea borders issue is a very complicated issue because we do not have exact demarcation of those borders. And there are some maps from the United Nations. But ever since the colonization and then later on the occupation of Palestine in 1948, we haven't had a clear demarcation of that border between Lebanon and Palestine. So what is happening right now is that the Israelis have had many activities in the sea, drilling out petrol, drilling out natural resources, and they're getting closer and closer to the line, which Lebanon believes is part of our Lebanon's economic waters. Now, as you know, earlier, we had a former Prime Minister, Senyura, who is backed by the West. He's very close to the United States. He had a unilateral agreement with Cyprus, and he seemed to have agreed to a certain line, which is Line 23, and that is not approved by the Lebanese government. And it was at a time where many questioned the legitimacy of that agreement that Senyura had with Cyprus and perhaps the United Nations as well, and they are calling for Line 29, which is a line that includes one of a very strategic field, which is called the Karish Field. Now, recently, as you mentioned, we had one of the oil companies coming to that area of Karish, trying to drill out from that area, and we clearly heard from Hezbollah's Secretary General saying that as long as that area is a disputed area, then there should not be any activities in that area at all. And he called on and actually warned about the ship, which is, I think the owner is Israeli Greek and owned by a UK company, to pull out immediately. And he said that there will be consequences if there is any activities over there until the negotiations are done. Now,
yeah, this is going to be a tough one, Firas Al-Najim, because we're looking at what has been described as an upcoming confrontation between, if you want to call it, Israel and Lebanon, which is obviously going to have Hezbollah dragged into it. Do you see that being a possibility?
Yes. I mean, Hezbollah is a credible organization, credible political party, a lot of experience with war. and defending Lebanon and liberating Lebanon. And they believe this is part of the sovereignty of Lebanon and part of the economy of Lebanon as well. This can right now support and strengthen the economy at this very hard time where there's a severe embargo imposed against the Lebanese nation, right? And these sanctions are really hurting the Lebanese nation, and there's a lot of problems, with the basics that the Lebanese people need. So this is a very important case right now to deal with. And Hezbollah is not looking for war. Hezbollah wants international law to be preserved and respected. And while the negotiations are happening, the Zionists don't have the right to go there and violate and take over areas and start to extract. But at the end of the day, this is the way that the Zionist regime. It's a settler colonial system, and it's established in this manner. It's established on stealing, on violating laws, human rights violations, as we can see what they're doing inside inside Palestine itself, going into Jerusalem, into Sheikh Jarrah, and different areas, and just stealing people's homes and demolishing people's homes, and expelling people from their motherland. So it's nothing surprising, to be honest with you, but it's got to be dealt with in a very decisive way and a very strong way. And Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah is working to secure the sovereignty of Lebanon. And he's warning them that we are ready for war, and the war will not stay only in Lebanon. It will expand inside the Palestinian territories.
Thank you so much for that. We appreciate it. Maryam Saleh there from Beirut. Firas Al-Najim, thank you for your comments. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. Manager of the Canadian Defenders for Human Rights from Ottawa, thank you. And with that, we come to an end for this news review. Thanks for tuning in.
And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. The United Nations Refugee Agency, UNHCR, has made a dramatic intervention to try to halt Britain's Home Secretary Priti Patel's plan to deport asylum seekers to Rwanda. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Diane Taylor and Rajiv Sial. The piece is titled, Home Office Misled Refugees About UN Involvement in Rwanda Plans, Court Told. The United Nations Refugee Agency has made a dramatic intervention to try to halt the British Home Secretary Priti Patel's plan to deport asylum seekers to Rwanda. In a late submission of evidence, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees claimed the Home Secretary Priti Patel misled refugees over the organization's support for the plan. The agency has also said the scheme failed to meet the required standards of legality and appropriateness for transferring asylum seekers from one country to another. It emerged on Friday, 10th of June, that the British government has cancelled the removal directions for three people who had asked the High Court to prevent their deportation. In the hearing, it emerged two more people will also have them cancelled. Letters sent by the Home Office to those seeking asylum assured them that the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, UNHCR, was closely involved in the scheme to send people to the East African country of Rwanda, the High Court was told. But a letter from the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, UNHCR, to the Home Office Minister, Tom Persgrove, questioned this claim. "We're also concerned by statements made in the letters indicating that UNHCR has not expressed substantial concerns with regard to the shortcomings in the capacity of the Rwandan asylum system," the agency wrote. The letter emerged at the first legal challenge of the policy, which was heard on Friday, 10th of June, at the Royal Courts of Justice. The refugee charities Detention Action and Care for Calais and the Public and Commercial Services Union have applied for an urgent interim injunction preventing any flights from leaving, including the first, until after its application for a judicial review can be heard. The High Court was told the UNHCR had a number of concerns about the asylum process in Rwanda, including discriminatory access to asylum, a lack of legal representation and interpreters, and difficulties in launching an appeal. Laura Dubinsky, QC, the barrister for the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, UNHCR, said the refugee agency was concerned about inaccuracies in Home Office claims about its involvement in the scheme, saying it in no way endorses it and had told the British government it believed it to be unlawful. Raza Hussain, QC, for the claimant, said Priti Patel had misrepresented the UNHCR's position. "These are concerns that have been communicated to the British authorities, and yet the Secretary of State's position is that the UNHCR has given this plan a green light. But this is a false claim," he said. In court documents, Home Office lawyers urged the court to reject the application, arguing it fails at the first stage, adding, "The claimants have not identified a serious issue to be tried, still less the strong case they allege for the grant of relief at trial." In the papers, Rory Dunlop QC and Matthew Gullick QC for the department said, "The application for interim relief should be dismissed. In the alternative, any order for interim relief should be limited." The claim and application ran to many hundreds of pages, the lawyers said, as they suggested there had been delays in serving the papers, arguing, "Given the volume of material that has now been served, this delay has prejudiced the defendant's ability to respond to the interim relief application." The High Court is due to hear a further challenge to the policy on Monday, brought by the refugee charity Asylum Aid and supported by the campaign group Freedom from Torture. Number 10 Downing Street said Prime Minister Boris Johnson was still hopeful the first flight would go ahead on Tuesday. A Number 10 Downing Street spokesperson said, "Yes, you're aware of the ongoing court case today, but we have set our position on why we think this is the right approach." Meanwhile, a High Court judge in London has ruled that a controversial deportation flight to Rwanda that was due to take off early next week can go ahead. The High Court judge, Mr. Justice Swift, refused to grant interim relief, urgent action in response to an injunction application made by several asylum seekers facing offshoring to Rwanda. Lawyers acting for the asylum seekers and the groups had argued the policy was unlawful and sought the urgent injunction to stop next week's planned flight and any other such flights ahead of a full hearing on the case later on this year. The decision will not stop individual refugees from further legal challenges to their removal to Rwanda or a judicial review of the policy, which Mr. Justice Swift said could take 6 weeks. The High Court judge, Mr. Justice Swift, supported submissions made by the Home Secretary Priti Patel and rejected the application to halt the Rwanda flight next Tuesday, but granted permission to the claimants to appeal, suggesting Court of Appeal judges would hear the case on Monday, 13th of June. The High Court judge, Mr. Justice Swift, said there was a material public interest in allowing the Secretary of State to be able to implement immigration control decisions. He also said that some of the risks of sending asylum seekers to Rwanda outlined by the claimants were very small and in their realms of speculation. Home Secretary Priti Patel will see this as a significant victory following concern that the offshoring plan would be stopped in the courts of law. The government has claimed that the plan is designed to deter migrants from making dangerous channel crossings and to break the business model of people smugglers. The Home Secretary, Priti Patel, welcomed the court's decision, saying people will continue to try and prevent their relocation through legal challenges and last-minute claims, but we will not be deterred in breaking the deadly people smuggling trade and ultimately saving lives. Prime Minister Boris Johnson also welcomed the ruling, saying, "We cannot allow people traffickers to put lives at risk, and our world-leading partnership will help break the business model of these ruthless criminals." Also, the scheme has been reportedly criticised in private by Prince Charles.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi and Brother Sajjad Hida. Brother Sajjad, assalamu alaikum. Welcome to the show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So for today's discussion, we want to be concerned with a very important topic from the life account of Imam Reza alayhi salam, and that is the debates that he had with the followers of different religions. It is documented that Ma'mun al-Abbasi holds some sessions with the presence of Imam Reza alayhi salam and the followers of the other religions, including Christianity, Judaism, and Zoroastrianism. And in that session, so many questions and answers, we can say, were done by both sides, Imam al-Reza and the followers of the other religions, and Imam al-Reza answered them according to their own books. First of all, Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi, give us a little bit details of the main intention of Ma'mun al-Abbasi to hold such sessions and such gatherings.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, obviously, we know that in the history, Aima alayhi salatu wasalam, or the infallible imams, they were under the surveillance or the, we can say, like a kind of observation of the rulers of the time. And Ma'mun al-Abbasi was one of those rulers, the Abbasid rulers, who was the ruler at the time of Imam Radha alayhi salatu wasalam. We know that obviously Banu Abbas and the Abbasid caliphates, they wanted this rulership of the Muslim Ummah for themselves.
Yes.
Whereas the real ruler of the Muslim Ummah were the infallible imams. And caliphate should be given, like the status of the caliphate should be given to these personalities. On the other hand, we know that Imam Radha alayhi salam was a famous personality because he was from the descendants of the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. And there were many people who were visiting him in Medina, since obviously Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, his grandfather, he had the university, an open university, where thousands of students were studying. So this family, the Imam's family, obviously it was famous. So somehow Mamun wanted to control him. And he doesn't wanted them to become famous, number one. Yes. On the other hand, obviously the zakat and the alms which were given, they were going to the imams. So he wanted to control that as well. On the other hand, because Ma'mun was in the territory of the Persian, we yes. can say like state or emperorship, where like Islam was, the people were converted to Islam. Here, there were many people who were the lovers of Ahlul Bayt. And he always had this fear that these lovers of Ahlul Bayt will one day, you know, they will raise against him.
Yes, okay.
So he wanted to control them as well.
That's right.
So there were many reasons. And the main okay. reason was to basically somehow legitimate mm-hmm. his rulership
okay.
as a legal rulership. And whatever he performs in his government, it is all legal. Okay. Because the infallible imam is next to him. So that's these right. were the okay. common, we can say, that's like.
Right. And the reasons. People, Brother Sajjad Haider, believed very much in the presence of Imam Ali ibn Musa Reza in Marv, Khurasan, the then Persia of that time. And Ma'mun al-Abbasi knew yeah. about this fame of the imam. Yeah. So maybe by holding such debates and sessions, he wanted to ruin the fame of the imam through this knowledge. He might understood that, for example, the imam might not be able to answer some of the questions of the other religions, for example, Christianity, Judaism, or Zoroastrianism. Yeah. Is it?
No doubt that he was kind of skeptical about the real personality of imam. If even if he was, he knew this, the love for the this. Authority and love for ruling the people that normally intrigues people to do actions against their own good judgment. So even if he knew, maybe he was not fair with himself.
Okay.
But there's a reality, no doubt, that he was planning in a way that you see that for... It's a kind of a plot and a kind of, yes. if you see the historical sequence of these things, that if it was just knowing about the personality of Imam, he could have sessions with Imam and solve his intellectual problems. But yes. I think there was a plot. Mm-hmm. And in some of the narrations which we read, we find that, for example, with the theologian of Khorasan, and he was named, I think, Sulaiman or Salman.
Yes.
He asks him and tells him that, only for once, I want you to overcome Imam. For once.
Uh-huh.
Why? And to prove that he's infallible. He's a person like us. He said, yeah. only one time, I want you to overcome him.
Okay.
Just a question, just a problem, just a, any
matter, any
matter
subject, yes.
That he okay. says, I don't know. Uh-huh. For one stance of
and
this.
And he was not
to
successful.
Prove that he's infallible. And it was to show that the normal people, the ordinary people, the Muslims generally, that this is like us. This the personality you are loving and this sacred personality you think that the progeny of Prophet is infallible. He wanted to prove practically that this is the wrong idea. So
that's right.
It was for himself, it was a very intelligent plan to bring every time a new scholar to prove that Imam was... the result was totally وَمَكَرُوا وَمَكَرَ اللَّهُ وَاللَّهُ خَيْرُ الْمَاكِرِينَ
yes.
And the result was against him. The more he brought scholars, the more the aspects of the great knowledge and
yes.
the ethical and spiritual and intellectual aspects of Imam were becoming more clear to people. So in one of the sayings, Imam also himself mentions this, that actually I am dealing with the multi-layer mm-hmm. Things. So in one, there is a the political thought.
Yes.
And there is the intellectual scenario where there are many disputes and new disputes are coming into the Muslim world. So Imam was dealing with both of them. Imam was trying to deal with the plot which Mamun had, and also to guide people in the right way.
That's all right. So that's very good. Very good, Brother Sajjad Haider. Nice elaboration. Thank you very much. But what were the main topics, I mean, the themes of these debates, Brother Said Mohsen?
Well, obviously, there were no main topics, we can see, obviously, because the first dialogue which was happened, Mamun al-Rashid has called four different, like the people from four different religions.
Religions, okay.
Like the Christians, the Jews, and there were other groups who were called, and they were asked to do debate with Imam. And it was general. So basically, as brother has mentioned, it was a matter that any topic can be discussed in that, obviously, session. And the only thing they want to hear is that he should say, like, I don't know. So we cannot say generally it was the main theme. But obviously, on the other hand, we see because it was between different religions, among different religions. So the main topic was, we can say, about God, mm-hmm. that who is God, or maybe, you know, why Christians, they believe that, for example, Jesus is the Son of God, whereas okay, Muslims Trinity. Believe, yes, yes, the Muslim believes that he's the prophet. And similarly with others was the same thing.
That's all right. And is it true that Imam answered their questions according to their own books? I mean, for example, the Old Testament and the New Testament. So it shows Imam's mastery over these languages, especially Hebrew language, isn't it?
Well, obviously, the history tells us that the Imam has answered everyone from their own book, uh-huh. from their own resources. And this is the way we do dialogue. You know, the dialogue doesn't mean that, for example, if I'm a Muslim, I'm doing a dialogue with a Christian, I bring proofs from the Quran and he brings uh-huh. proof from the Bible. That is not the way of doing dialogue. The dialogue is in a way that you prove something from their own book.
Okay.
For example, if I want someone to believe in Islam, I need to bring proofs from their book. Mm-hmm. And if they want me to become Christian, for example, or Jew, they need to bring something from the Quran.
Right.
As this is happening today, obviously, okay. when the dialogues are happening. So basically, this is true. That's the first thing. The second thing is, obviously, when we talk about the knowledge of Imam, they have the ilm or the knowledge which has been given by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Yes.
Which is known as ilm al-ladunni, which has been given by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So they do not have this ordinary knowledge that we have. Mm-hmm. And the difference is, when we talk about the knowledge, we are gaining knowledge.
Yes.
We come to this world
to acquire
obviously we're
knowledge.
Born, we acquire knowledge. Yes. We spend some time in learning alphabets, for example, and then yes. the other things. Whereas the Imams, when we talk about them, the ilm is been given to them. It is something which is in them. Mm-hmm. And they do have the knowledge of it. And we believe that.
Especially in the modern world, when you yes. talk about such themes, it is very much difficult to understand what does it mean by ilm al-ladunni, I mean the God-given knowledge. And because the people usually think that the type of knowledge we are talking about is the science in the laboratories, but it is not. Yeah. I mean, the nature and the, we can say, the very nature of such type of knowledge and is very much different.
It's not hard to believe because, you know, in the prophets, even we see like Jesus, the prophet Jesus, alayhi salam, when he came in front of, you know, the people, when Lady Mary, yes. salamu alayhi, she brought.
Yes.
So he started to talk.
Yes.
Like, I am the prophet of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Yes. I'm the abd of Allah, servant of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and I'm being sent to you.
In the cradle. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So we have all these things. There are many other examples in the history. So when we refer to the history, we find all these stories, and these are the true.
That's right.
History, that no one has denied it.
And you know, Ma'mun al-Abbasi and the Abbasis were famous to create the golden age of the science and knowledge. But all of a sudden, an imam who is under the control, under the supervision, and is not a man from the laboratory, is a man from the lineage of Prophet Muhammad, comes and answers all the questions on theology, the history of religion, Trinity, and this and that. So this must be a real big disgrace for Ma'mun al-Abbasi, isn't it?
Yeah, no doubt that there's a lot of difference,
yes.
a clear difference between a person with a materialistic perspective about the life and the world, and who has based his own activities, whether they are knowledge-related or whether they are his related to his action, is based on the materialistic goals, with a person who has not limited himself to just the materialistic aspect, a person who has is related in one aspect, he is related to the divinity, to the God. He has a spiritual, a higher level of spiritual relation with Allah. And ethically, he has the greatest qualities of moral excellences.
Yes.
And in practice, he is a role model for action, for good deeds. So such a personality is totally different. It's actually for, if you go to the mentality and psychology of such people who want to have the hegemony and rule the world, they see such personality as a challenge for themselves. He sees that there is a person, he is more wise than me, he's spiritually more powerful than me, he rules the hearts of people.
That's
and
right.
How he that it's the irony of the history, you know, that we come to the such rulers who have the this dream of becoming the role model for whole universe and human society, and then they come with the to, when they see such personalities like Imam Reza alayhi salam. So that envy works here, and the hatred which results in the result of their envy towards such personality, instead of being having submission to such personalities and giving them place to guide humanity towards their goals, they try to fight them. And that's an irony of history, that that's always the kings and the people of power were acting with the prophets in such a negative way. So it's
that's right. They say that the tomb of Imam al-Reza alayhi salam and Harun al-Rashid are in the same place. But see nowadays who is visiting who. The people go to visit Imam al-Reza alayhi salam and not Harun al-Rashid with his greatest palace. You know that he was one of the greatest Abbasid kings and his son Ma'mun al-Abbasi. You know, they had really big empire, but they are not remembered today. Imam Reza alayhi salam is remembered today. People in the city of Mashhad, called Merv or Khorasan at that time, you know, they go there, they pay visit over there. And the soul of such people like the imams really is helpful to them today in a very positive way.
Sorry to interrupt you. Even Quran has cited such a thing. إِنَّ الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَعَمِلُوا الصَّالِحَاتِ سَيَجْعَلُ لَهُمُ الرَّحْمَنُ وُدَّ. It's a reality. It's a reality that someone who is embarked on the journey of submission to Allah and he's embarked on the path of faith and good deeds, Allah says, I will put his love and the attraction towards him in hearts of people.
Very good.
So in all the history, if you see that we have philosophers in the history, we have reformists, we have different influential personalities in the history, but at the end, when you see after the centuries, even now, the one who is ruling on the hearts of people is the personalities like Imam Reza alayhi salam, the prophets.
Right. That's right.
So
there is a famous quote by his father, Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam, referring to his son Ali, and says that your brother Ali ibn Musa is the most knowledgeable among the progeny of the prophet. You know, and this really, and as I said, I think in other programs, believing in Imam al-Reza alayhi salam means that you believe in 12 imams, because there is no denomination or we can say Shiite sect created after Imam al-Reza alayhi salam. So he is really the missing link in these chains of imamate. It shows the great position of this holy imam. We have the chance of having this imam and his holy shrine in our country, Islamic Republic of Iran, in Mashhad. And today is the birthday anniversary of Imam al-Reza alayhi salam. May Allah give us the chance of paying the visit and homage to the city of Mashhad and the holy shrine and holy chamber of Imam al-Reza alayhi salam. Thank you very much for your presence in the program Viewpoints. It was very kind of you talking about the debates of Imam al-Reza alayhi salam with the followers of other religions. We would like to express again our congratulations on the birthday anniversary of Imam al-Reza alayhi salam. If you got a chance and paid a visit to the city of Mashhad and Imam al-Reza holy shrines, do not forget us in your prayers.
and supplications. For more information on this program and to download for free our other episodes of this program, you can visit our website at parstoday.com/en/Call of Islam page. Also, our YouTube channel, Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Assalamu alaikum, Ya Ali ibn Musa al-Riza.
إِنَّ فِي الْجَنَّةِ نَهْرًا مِّن لَّبَنٍ إِنَّ فِي الْجَنَّةِ نَهْرًا مِّن لَّبَنٍ لِعَلِيٍّ وَحُسَيْنٍ وَحَسَنٍ لِعَلِيٍّ وَحُسَيْنٍ وَحَسَنٍ كُلُّ مَن كَانَ مُحِبًّا لَّهُمْ كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Convincing a deeply polarized American public that the January 6th Capitol riot was not a spontaneous act of violence, but the culmination of a months-long plot by former President Donald Trump and his allies to undermine the results of the 2020 presidential election, is no easy task for the House Select Committee investigating the deadly assault on the Capitol. We have prepared for you an article written by Lauren Gambino. The piece is titled, January 6th Hearing, Trump Was at Heart of Plot That Led to Attempted Coup. House Select Committee investigating the deadly January 6th assault on the U.S. Capitol in 2021 said former President Donald Trump was at the center of a sprawling conspiracy to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election that culminated in an attempted coup. With a shocking new accounting of the worst attack on the halls of U.S. Congress in more than two centuries, the committee outlined the gripping detail over the course of 2 hours on Thursday night, 9th of June. The grave threat posed to American democracy then and now by the former president's actions. In new evidence, Congresswoman Liz Cheney, a Republican from Wyoming and the committee's vice chair, said of Donald Trump, "Aware of the rioters' chance to hang Mike Pence, his vice president, the president responded with his statement, maybe our supporters have the right idea. Mike Pence deserves it." Congressman Benny Thompson, a Mississippi Democrat and chair of the committee, said, "The American people deserve answers," adding, "So tonight and over the next few weeks, We're going to remind you of the reality of what happened on that day. Congressman Benny Thompson and Congresswoman Liz Cheney laid out what they described as the unconstitutional misconduct of a former president who continues to peddle the lie that the election he lost to the Democrats Joe Biden was stolen from him, a lie they argue that he knows to be false. Liz Cheney said during the primetime proceedings, "All Americans should keep in mind this fact. On the morning of 6th of January 2021, President Donald Trump's intention was to remain President of the United States despite the lawful outcome of the 2020 presidential election, and in violation of his constitutional obligation to relinquish power." Their presentation featured never-before-seen video clips from the attack by extremist supporters of Donald Trump, who stormed the U.S. Capitol building to try to stop Congress from certifying Joe Biden's win. In a cinematic display meant to grip a weary public, the House panel weaved video footage of the violence together with live testimony and videotaped depositions from some of Donald Trump's closest allies and family members. These included the former Attorney General William Barr, Donald Trump's daughter and White House advisor Ivanka Trump, Donald Trump's son-in-law and advisor Jared Kushner, and a longtime aide and spokesperson Jason Miller. The effect was piercing. The first of six public hearings offered revelations on what Congressman Benny Thompson described as a sprawling multi-step conspiracy aimed at overturning the presidential election. Members of the audience gasped when Liz Cheney said Donald Trump, after being informed the mob was calling for Mike Pence to be hanged, told aides that perhaps his vice president deserved it. Donald Trump was furious that Mike Pence, presiding over a joint session of Congress in what is typically a ceremonial role, refused to reject the certification of Joe Biden's victory, as Trump publicly and privately pressured him to do. The committee showed a clip of William Barr saying he repeatedly told Donald Trump in no uncertain terms that he had lost the election, and the claims of it being stolen because of widespread voting fraud was simply untrue. In another interview, Ivanka Trump said she accepted William Barr's determination that the presidential election had been fair. On Friday morning, 10th of June, Donald Trump posted on his own Truth Social platform, having been banned from Twitter, calling William Barr weak and frightened, and his own daughter checked out. Republican Congresswoman Liz Cheney also announced that multiple House Republicans sought pardons from Donald Trump for their involvement in the insurrection, including Congressman Scott Perry of Pennsylvania, who declined a request to testify before the committee. Scott Perry's office denied the allegation. The evening presentation also included witnesses' testimony from Nick Quested, a British documentary filmmaker who was embedded with the far-right Proud Boys militia group that led the storming of the Capitol. Video footage he filmed helped chronicle the Proud Boys' involvement in planning the assault. On Friday morning, 10th of June, British documentary filmmaker Nick Quested told ABC's Good Morning America that at the point the far-right extremists he was filming breached the first barriers on the outskirts of the Capitol, it all changed, as men protesting far-left Antifa turned into rioters challenging the outnumbered police officers. He said, "It crossed the Rubicon at that point, and the mob was pouring over the Capitol steps like water." The panel also heard from Caroline Edwards, a Capitol police officer who described in harrowing detail how she was assaulted by the mob, some armed with bats, clubs, and even spray. Caroline Edwards said she was knocked unconscious on the steps, and after she came to, she ran to the overwhelmed officers trying to stop insurrectionists breaking into the Senate. She said the scene was like a war zone, and she was slipping on her fellow officers' blood. She added, "It was carnage. It was chaos." Drawing on the findings of the nearly year-long investigation, which includes more than 100 subpoenas, 1,000 interviews and 100,000 documents, the Select Committee will attempt to establish a comprehensive sequence of events that built to the cold January day when Donald Trump encouraged his supporters to fight like hell. The attack, which played out in real time on national television, left more than 100 police officers injured as they clashed with a pro-Trump mob. 9 people lost their lives in connection with the riot, including a woman who was fatally shot by a Capitol Police officer as she attempted to breach the House chamber. Convincing a deeply polarized American public that the Capitol riot was not a spontaneous act of violence, but rather the culmination of a months-long plot by Donald Trump and his allies to undermine the results of the presidential election, is no easy task for the committee. Congressman Benny Thompson argued that American democracy remains in danger, as many Republicans at local and national level continue to boost the myth that the 2020 presidential election was stolen from Donald Trump and use it for their own election campaigns. Congressman Benny Thompson said the conspiracy to thwart the will of the people is not over. He said 6th of January and the lies that led to insurrection have put 2.5 centuries of constitutional democracy at risk. The world is watching what we do here, he said. The Select Committee is composed of 7 Democrats and 2 Republicans. Speaking with the Summit of the Americas in Los Angeles, California, before the hearing on Wednesday, 8th of June, President Biden said the assault on the Capitol was a clear and flagrant violation of America's Constitution. He said a lot of Americans are going to see for the first time some of the details. Hundreds have been charged in connection with the events of 6th of January 2021, including some with seditious conspiracy. The hearings will resume in the coming days.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.